Hey guys, how you doing? It's Coach Treggs here, the founder of 30 Plus Men's Fitness, and welcome to the next edition of the Coach Treggs podcast. Today, I'm very, very grateful to be joined by former West Ham captain, Aston Villa player, and Bolton Wanderers, to name but a few, Nigel Riococca. How are you, Nigel?
I'm good, thank you.
Brilliant stuff. Like I said to you when we just before we started recording, Nigel, I'm really grateful for you taking your time out today. Obviously, you're in the East Coast of America now. I'm looking forward to finding out all about that story. I know you're a busy guy. I actually reach out to so many players and only like a small percentage get back to me. So thanks for making it happen, bud.
No, no problem at all.
All right, buddy. So what I want to do is I want to always sort of start at the beginning. I know that you're 37 because I've done some research on you. And obviously you were kind of raised in Sierra Leone, right? Until you were sort of 6 years old and then came back to the UK. And that's where it all started for you with the football. Do you want to give us a little bit of background about that?
Yeah, I was born in England and then taken back as a baby to Sierra Leone. Yep. And then I came back when I was still young, about 6-7 years old. And then from then I've been in England since, you know. So obviously for people who don't know, Sierra Leone is in West Africa. And it is part of the British colony. It's one of the British colonies from many years ago. And there's a few of us in England. And even Carlton Cole, his heritage is from Sierra Leone. And then obviously the famous Idris Elba as well. Yep. Heritage from Sierra Leone as well. So growing up in England from young, grew up most well. I started off in like the Southwark area, Elephant and Castle. And then moved out to Thornton Heath, where I pretty much grew up most of my life, in Croydon.
Yeah. How was that growing up there?
It was good. It was good. I think one thing now with obviously as life progresses and you experience different things, I think that growing up in England and in that London area is fantastic. It's probably the best thing that can happen to you, because when you travel around the world and you meet people from all over the world and you go to all these different cities, the uniqueness of London for me was fantastic. And it was such unique and great development for a human being, because you mix with so many different cultures. You know, I've got friends from different religions, different backgrounds, different beliefs. And you learn so much in England and London because it's all there. It's interconnected. Some of the other amazing cities in the world, yes, they are diverse, but you have to go to certain areas in particular to mix with that group. While in London, walking around anywhere, getting on the bus, you're going to see so many different people from different cultures. And I think that now I'm at this age and, you know, living over here, you appreciate it so much more.
Absolutely, mate. I love that. So you started playing football as a youngster, and I think you initially got picked up by Wimbledon, right?
Yeah, I was playing as a youngster just for the fun of it. You know, playing for your school, you play for your county, Croydon, the borough and the county, sorry. And back then, it's not like it is now. You know, back then it was really a small amount of kids wanted to play football to become professionals, because it wasn't seen as something that players, especially kids from my demographic, parents would want to push you into that background. You know, they want you to be a doctor, a lawyer, an accountant, a real professional. Footballers wasn't the top priority from a lot of players from where I come from in my demographic. So there was only a few kids who were in these professional clubs. For me, it was playing for my local county and borough, and then you'd always dream of getting picked up by a professional club looking at you. And the time I got scouted by Wimbledon, it was actually a Fulham scout that I was supposed to speak to on that day, because the manager told me a Fulham scout's watching you, like she's going to speak to you after the game. Didn't get a phone call, and I got a phone call from a Wimbledon scout that was at the game instead. And then, you know, the rest is history.
Brilliant. So what was that like, that moment that you got scouted? Because obviously you must have come, like you got the message from your parents or your school or something like that. And what was that like?
It was amazing, because at that time, again, like I said, I was still young, and at that time, it wasn't reachable as it is nowadays, thanks to social media and stuff like that. It was a lot more about community, and it was a more smaller circle. You know, the fans were always there because the fans make the club.
Yeah.
But for everything else along these lines, it was a lot more small and difficult circle, and it was to get into that. To be scouted, it was amazing for me. It was like a dream come true, because you know so many of the other guys who were playing for these professional clubs, and you know that was the goal from when you're playing Sunday League football, because we were still playing grassroots.
Sure.
And that's when grassroots was probably a lot more stronger than being at the professional clubs. You know, the professional clubs was the top 1% elite kids, but grassroots was still very big for the amount of kids that was playing and, you know, local teams.
So did you sign schoolboy forms actually with Wimbledon from quite a young age, and then just sort of develop through until you left school? How did it work?
Yeah, it's the same with Wimbledon. You know, I joined, I think it was under 13s or 14s, signed schoolboy forms, and then you go through the whole process of training while at school. And then you get your YT forms. You know, when you're 15, you get judged for getting the youth development forms, and then you get that and you go through the whole system. You know, the system back then was different, but I find it a lot better and more beneficial than the system now. I think the system now it's a lot more difficult. I think there's so many kids who have the dream now, and because of social media and what they see and what's out there, I think they kind of get sidetracked and see the golden ticket and see the lifestyle and the money more so than actually pursuing the dream of becoming a professional football player. And then some of these clubs now, it's a numbers game for them. You know, you get kids who are playing under 23s. And if some of these kids are not good enough to make it in the first team, they should have been let go a long time ago. You know, we came through the system of playing under 19s. And then you go into the reserve team. And then from reserve team, it's either first team or, you know, you go and try somewhere else. But a lot of these clubs now, especially like Premier League clubs, it's a numbers game for them. And they've got young kids who play under 23s and they're losing valuable experience by getting regular first team football. And the time that they leave these big clubs, it's a hard task to kind of make it as a professional again, because it's just such a numbers game now.
And I think some of the money these young lads are on at Premier League clubs, even if you said they're like playing for under 23s, it's going to be incredible. It's almost like you kind of like you think you've made it, and you can almost lose a little bit of desire. I mean, what were the terms like for you financially as a YT? Because talking to some of the
it's different now. I mean, even with us at Wimbledon, compared to some of the kids who were Arsenal, Chelsea, like I said, that then was when football was a small circle. Like everyone kind of knew everyone, so we knew that some of these kids at bigger clubs were getting paid crazy money, but then for them still the desire was still there. It was still to reach it, to get to that next level, and it was more about a love for the game and the lifestyle. You know, it's only nowadays that it's more so you see a lot more about the lifestyle than you do about the game, and then social media is out there. But it's just sometimes it's just in certain kids, that's just the reality. You know, you can always see the kids that have that in them compared to the rest.
So when you sign these YT forms, am I right in thinking that you do 2 years as a YTS, right, straight from school? Were you in digs, or obviously you live local, so you stayed at home? And are you literally washing the boots and sorting the kit and all that kind of stuff? Tell me a little bit more about that.
That was the good old days. You know, that was the good days of what football was about. You know, for me, I just think it's changed so much now. And for us, yes, we had to do chores. We had to wash boots. We had to do so many different things. And, you know, I washed Robbie Earl's boots, and he was very generous to me at Christmas time. Right. And, you know, that was part of the earning the right, you know, the process of it. And some of the things that happened there and we did, you probably couldn't say in this day and age now. Yeah. But it was really the good old days. You know, I think recently someone sent me a clip of, I think, Gary Neville interviewing Roy Keane for one show that he's got. And you hear Roy Keane talking about what they used to do after training on a Wednesday and go out. That was the lifestyle that we kind of grew in. You know, it wasn't 100% as professional, but it was still the good old days. Because if you think about it, and I was just having a conversation with someone the other day about some of these athletes, whether it's football or whatever it is, that played in our generation, in the past generation, if people knew about their lifestyle outside the sport and you look at still what they achieved and how they are, you've got to give them unbelievable credit, because they weren't as professional as this modern day athletes are with all at their disposal now. Mm. But they burnt the candle on both ends and they still achieved greatness. You just got to give some people credit for being able to do that, because it's crazy when you look back now at the lifestyle of how we were living and what we were doing to some of these people now in the modern day and age.
Yeah, I mean, it was this whole kind of drinking culture, wasn't it, really? And, you know, I've heard from so many players that, you know, they'd be out on big sessions and then, you know, turning up to training or turning up to pre-season and just getting away with it. And you just think in this day and age with the social media and the camera phones, it's not impossible for players, but it's going to be a lot tougher, right?
It's definitely going to be a lot tougher. You know, footballers now are tremendously under the spotlight compared to our generation, where, you know, camera phones were only just coming out and you could still have a good life. But I just think that also the knowledge wasn't quite there. It wasn't quite up there yet, right, of today, of what to do and how to do certain things. And you know, the stretching regime, the injury prevention and stuff like that. You know, we came from an old school generation where it was a bit more drill sergeants, and you generally all get tarnished to the same brush. There wasn't really that much individuality. Maybe some managers might give a little bit more freedom to the artists of the team, the creative players, or the ones who need to be wrapped in cotton wool, but the rest of you, you all fall under the same category and the same brush.
I'm with you. Okay, look, let's move on and get into that professional career. I've got your Wikipedia up here, as I said. Tell us about breaking through into that first team. You know, I'm a massive football fan, right? That was my dream growing up, and you know, I think I got the next best job. I work in fitness, and I really enjoy what I do. But whenever I speak to people like yourself, I just want to know what it was like to actually play in front of a big crowd.
Do you know what people ask all the time? And for me, it's just something you can't put in words. I think with the whole process of being at Wimbledon, it kind of happened so quick, you know, and Wimbledon always known for being a selling club. And then when you got offered your professional contract, it's something that you could just never put into words. You know, your first professional contract from the dream, you get basically a memory cycle of when you first started playing for 10MB, your local Sunday team, your county, your borough. Then even when you sign for Wimbledon on schoolboy forms, you're excited. But when you get the pro forms, it's a different level. And I think what made it so good in our generation is the first team was always reachable, because you could always see the first team training. You could always see their training pitch. So that kind of gave you that extra desire of, that's the pitch I want to be on. Sure. And the coaching back then was really good as well, because the coaches that we had at Wimbledon kept you motivated to say, you don't want to be on this pitch, you want to be on that pitch. So you always worked harder because it was in reaching and touching distance. And obviously, again, now you go to the modern day and age now, the first team is generally separated from the under 23s in different areas and stuff like that. But when you get that pro form, it's just honestly something you just can't put in words. You know, it's just a dream come true, and you start thinking about playing in front of fans and, you know, 15, 20,000 stadiums and the historic stadiums you get to go to if you have a successful career, and just, you know, if fans are going to make a song about you and all types of stuff like that. So, But at our age, the biggest thing you think about was, what's your rating going to be on Championship Manager? That was
for us. Brilliant.
It's like, what are you going to get on Championship Manager? That was before FIFA took over, because Championship Manager was the game.
Oh, mate, yeah, that got me through university, that did, trust me. So do you remember your debut, bud? Do you remember your debut for Wimbledon?
Yeah. It was all a blur. I came on the last day of the season. I didn't think I'd be in the first team squad. You get in the first team squad again, you're still riding an adrenaline long, probably year and a half to 2 years after you sign your first pro contract, because everything is so new. Traveling with the first team, and it's kind of like in your head, you're thinking you've made it, but not fully made it, because you know you have to continue to perform at a high level to stay there. So I came on in the last 5 minutes or 10 minutes against Barnsley, last game of the season, I believe. And it was at home at Selhurst Park. And it was just pure adrenaline. Like, the whole body from head to toe was just adrenaline bound, like just running all over the place. And it was amazing.
Wow. And you were what, 17, 18 at the time?
I think just turned 18.
Amazing. Amazing.
Just turned 18.
What did you feel like afterwards? You must have just feel like you've arrived.
It's just total euphoria. Total euphoria, and you just can't put it into words. And it's just because it's a dream and achievement. It's just whatever dream that you have in whatever industry you want to do. And when you reach that goal or that first major goal, it's just pure euphoria. You can't really ever put that into words. And I think that, again, it's only football players who've been through that and had that experience and know exactly what I'm talking about. It's difficult to really explain to everyone else and regular people, because it's just so, it's euphoric.
So you played for Wimbledon from 2002 to 2004, 58 appearances, 6 goals. And then you got the move to West Ham. That's where I really remember you from, because I will come on to it, but I always remember watching that FA Cup final against Liverpool. I was actually on holiday in Italy, and I'm a massive Man U fan, so I wanted West Ham to win. And I'm in a bar, and I was blown away by that game. But we'll come on to that, because you've gone to West Ham, and you know, you ended up, you know, 120 appearances, 11 goals. You played in a cup final. Tell us about the West Ham experience, bud.
Again, it's just, for me, it's the good old days. You know, people always ask about what it's like, and I think when I look back on my career, I wouldn't change anything really. You know, going through at Wimbledon, I learned a lot. Again, I think with Wimbledon, the diversity that was at that club was fantastic. You know, we had loads of players coming through, again, different races, different religion backgrounds and stuff like that, which was great. And it really was a family club. And I was fortunate. I went from one family club to another family club.
Yeah.
You know, West Ham was a lot more demanding, a lot more bigger fan base. So it's a bigger fan base than Wimbledon, the reality of it. But their fans are very demanding. And again, yes. You know, went to a situation where it was like myself and it was a young team. We had, you know, Hayden Mullins, Anton Ferdinand, Marlon Harewood, Bobby Zamora. Oh, yeah. We had a dressing room that was packed with personality.
Yes.
And I think it's a lot of the personality that took that team to the levels it got to, because there was so much competitiveness in training and also on the pitch on a Saturday. We demanded so much of each other and it literally was like a family atmosphere. And it wasn't just the players there. It was also the backroom staff at the club that had been there for so long. You know, the chef, Tim, and so many different people. Eddie, the kit man, was one of our kit guys there and he's still there. And it literally was just like a family club. But the thing about West Ham, which was so unique and I found, was whenever something happened at that club, there was a way it always leak out into the press, because someone who works at the club will overhear conversation, and because that's their club, somehow things always used to get into the press, and it was just crazy. But I just think that it's the personalities that we had in that dressing room that really carried us to those heights that we went and reached.
You were there when the whole Mascherano and Tevez thing went down, right?
Yeah, I was a captain then.
Tell me more about that, because that was just incredible at the time.
Honestly, I just didn't really know too much about it. All I know is there was a big thing being made about two players that were signing from Argentina and they're coming in. But we had no idea about the deal and how the deal was done until later on.
Yeah.
So they came in, and again, they were some unique characters, and we've had some unique characters at that club throughout my time, you know. And
yeah.
It was an interesting time with those guys. That's the funniest thing, you know. Tevez is just Tevez. He's a unique character.
Did you have any nights out with them and that, with Tevez and that?
No, not really. They just kind of kept themselves to themselves, you know. Right. And for them, it was a big change. I think that's something as older people need to realise, that when you're young at that age and then you're going to a new country and you're going to a new environment, a new culture, it plays a big part and it's not easy, you know. And it's down for the clubs to try and make these players feel comfortable. And when they came in, you got two unique individuals. You know, Mascherano didn't work out for him as well there, because he struggled. And especially in the games when we tried to play him in a 4-4-2, he really couldn't handle a 4-4-2 of the Premier League, you know, because it's one-on-one and it's too athletic for him at the time. And if you look at him when he became really successful, so to speak, and really established himself, was when he went to Liverpool and they played him in the five. They gave him that kind of free role. But if you matched him up one-on-one with some of the players at the time in the Premier League, he struggled because he couldn't handle that athleticism. And that was when generally managers and coaches would be like, that's your man, you handle your man and you handle your man. But if you're playing with someone that's not as athletic and is getting beat, then you have to leave your man and go and cover and try and help. And he did struggle a bit. But yeah, you know, we didn't find out much about the deal till after. But there were some unique characters. And again, you know, you've got those two in there. You had Teddy Sheringham. Roy Carroll. Yeah. We had Carlton Cole. We had so many unique players in there. Yeah. And it was just, it you can't put it into words. And it's kind of like what Roy Keane said, that those were the good old days, because the stuff that happened in that dressing room and the camaraderie we had. And
yeah.
Again, about the lifestyle, we were out as a team.
I was going to say,
three times a week. Generally, and like we don't know how we ended up being so successful we were, but I guess it's the bonding that we did off the pitch that really is what kept us solid together, because we were out a lot, like every Saturday,
China
Sunday,
and all that,
Tuesday, exactly.
Well, how did you? Because you know you're the man about town. Then you know you're playing, you're captain for West Ham, you know your big crowds and everything like that. How did you handle the kind? I know there wasn't the camera phone generation, but how did you handle the fame? Did you love it or did you not like it, or did you thrive from?
I didn't ever look at myself as famous, you know, and people who interacted with me back then, they'll tell you that I just always looked at myself as just a regular guy. You know, I pursued my goal or ambition to become a professional football player, and that's all I did, you know, and I achieved it, and I just wanted to stay there as long as I can. But I never looked at myself as any different from anyone else, and I always believe in treating people how you like to be treated.
I love that.
That was just my simple thing in life. I treat people how I like to be treated, you know, and also I let people know I'm a human being like you. Don't let football fool you, or just because you're a footballer, you think, oh, our life is all fantastic and great. We go through problems ourselves. We're going to have our good days and our bad days, you know, and if I'm having a bad day, respect that I'm having a bit of a bad day and just want to be left alone, and just realize that that could be you on the opposite end as well. You know, when you have your bad days, you want to be left alone, you know, and I think that that was the thing that I felt was a bit misunderstood, where people seem to believe that just because you're a professional football player, that your life is all great, you know, because you're earning so much money and that's it. What can you be worried about? What problems can you have? But we all have different paths and journeys into making it as professional football players, and we all have to deal with social things a lot more different than one another. You know, it's not just all kumbaya, sing along and happy life. You know, some players get through some real depressed times. You know, I'm not going to name any names, but I know a player was earning crazy money at one of the big London clubs at one point, but he wasn't playing, and, you know, and he had a real deep spell of depression, you know, and that's what, from our generation of players, it was all about making it and playing. So regardless of how much money you're earning at the time, when you're not playing and the manager's not picking you, you do go through some real deep, dark, depressive states. And that happened a lot. But now it's a lot more acceptable to speak about it. So to, you know, people are a lot more comfortable to put it out there. But in our generation, you have to really suffer in silence. That's it.
Well, I'd like to come on to that when we talk about, obviously, your retirement and how you've made the adjustment. But like I said, I want to talk to you about that cup final in 2006. The game, it was at the Millennium Stadium, wasn't it? Against Liverpool. You know, you're going to be talking 80,000 fans, boiling hot day, and you almost beat them, didn't you? You almost beat them.
Yeah.
Tell me about
It's absolutely amazing. Like, there's nothing like an FA Cup final, especially. I'll probably say, back then, the FA Cup was such a big thing, more so than nowadays. And the reality of it is, a lot more people are more interested in who wins the Premier League and then who wins the Champions League. That's it. But the FA Cup is still such a special and magical cup. And I think that the dominance of these big superpower clubs now is kind of taking the fun out of it. You know, you don't really get as many giant killing as we used to back in the day, which made the cup so unique. But to play an FA Cup final, the build-up for the whole week before. And again, this was when it was just mainly newspapers and TVs, not so much social media. So it was just amazing. And then you step out there, the start of the game, you get there. The whole thing about obviously wearing a suit and everything, it's amazing. It's an experience you can never forget. And then when it's two massive clubs, you know, with fantastic fan bases, you know, Liverpool have always had a tremendous fan base, but take nothing away from West Ham. You know, West Ham is a fantastic club that when the fans are behind you, nothing can stop you. And, you know, they were so passionate that day for the cup.
Yeah.
And they were so involved in it. And, you know, they were so supportive because, again, it's a club that takes you through a roller coaster of emotions. It's just amazing. You know, it's a fingertip save, I believe, from a header from Marlon Harewood that kind of stopped us from maybe winning that game that day.
And then Gerrard gets the equaliser in the last kick of the game. And I'll never forget, I think it's been on YouTube and that, but I lip read you. Alan Pardew's gone to give you like a pep talk, and you just turned around and went, I'm fucked, mate.
Yeah. it was hard. It was hard, but there's nothing you could do about it. But I just think as a neutral, if you watch that game back again, that's what football is about.
Yeah.
I think that for any neutral who watched that game, and everyone, they loved it. And I think for us, what we had, even though we lost and we're disappointed, we didn't want to lose. I think that every West Ham fan was grateful because they know we gave it our all.
Everything.
And that's all they wanted. You gave it your all. You can look at yourself in the mirror. You didn't go there. You didn't get embarrassed and get battered for 90 minutes and were just happy to be in an FA Cup final. No, we made that FA Cup final as much as Liverpool made it. And I think it was just a fantastic day all around.
Some players I've spoke to actually say, like, when they play in that amount, when they play in that kind of arena with that many fans, you can't hear anything. You can't hear your teammate. What's that like, you know, when those conditions, the heat, and all you can hear is like the fans, and you can't. How do you adapt to that, Nigel?
I mean, I felt fortunately got used to it because I was playing from a young age. You know, after I made my Wimbledon debut, I ended up captaining the team at 19 years old, you know, playing in the Championship. So we played in a lot of big stadiums then. and you get fans and you get that whole thing. So you get used to it really and truly.
Right.
And you condition yourself well. But I've always been very loud vocally. I've been loud from a young age. So I guarantee whoever team I'm playing with, my teammates can definitely hear.
Yeah, yeah. Brilliant.
So, yeah, so in that occasion, yeah, you do get, I understand, you do get kind of a bit of a white noise kind of syndrome.
Yeah.
Where you're just so into it, but still there's aspects of teammates where you'd be able to hear, you pull them close, you talk to them and stuff like that. But it's goosebumps. And now I'm talking to you now, it's bringing back memories of that thing of the FA Cup and everything like that. So the whole experience is unbelievable. It really is. And I think that, like I said, it's because it meant so much more back in our days than it does now.
When you walk out and that, and you know, you're there, you're next to Liverpool team, Gerrard was captain and you captain on the day, yeah?
Yeah.
What does that do to you? What do you shrink, or do your legs go numb? What does that do to the body? Because it's, you can't
fight. Honestly, I'm someone that I've always been very competitive. So those type of things there didn't really get to me. So for me, I always looked at it from a different mental side of it. I looked at it from the fact of all these 80,000 people are here to watch you play. Like, what do you have to lose? You either go and seize the moment, or you just crumble, you know. And that's never been me. I rather seize the moment, because that's what you say in your head. 80,000 people are sitting in this stadium to watch you, to watch. No, and I wasn't just saying that in a sense of just myself. I was saying in the sense of you guys, all of us as professional football players, like, what do you have to lose? Like, it's all to gain and there's nothing to lose. You know, this is what you dreamt about. Now you're in the moment. It's either you seize it or you let it pass you by. And regardless whether it was Gerrard, Scholes, or whoever I played against, I never had a fear factor. You know, I never had a fear factor. There was a respect, a level of respect. But it's the also fact of, I'm going to make sure you remember my name. You know, everyone remembers you and knows you. But for me, my goal and my mental approach was, I'm going to make sure that they remember my name. And that's how I've always kind of left it. And there's always been a good respect, a mutual respect against those guys. And even when you see them outside of football, you know, the Scholeses and all that, they are polite and you'd have a conversation. And one thing about Paul Scholes, I'd say, is when you're, even though we're going off topic.
Yeah. No, I love it.
Scholes is he's a funny guy, because he's one of those ones where he couldn't tackle, and you know you couldn't tackle. Paul Scholes came into a tackle with you, he's coming to hurt you. He's not coming to tackle, he's coming to hurt
you.
I
love it. Yeah.
And you'd always see him, and it's always players that he didn't really like or he didn't respect, that he'd go in with a challenge and it would be a dirty challenge. But then since you've seen him outside of it, there's always that respect. And if these guys didn't respect you, they won't really give you the time of day to even give you a conversation.
Love it. Love it. Okay, I want to move on. I want to get straight to it. I mean, what happened with when you left West Ham? Because, you know, you played 120 games with them. You captained them in a cup final. And then in 2007, you go to Aston Villa. What happened there?
It was just, it was the time, you know, there was things that go on behind closed doors that fans don't really know about. And I think now if people have a bit of intelligence, I think they can work and understand that there is politics in football. You know, it's not as hunky-larry as people think. And it's not that players don't want to be loyal to the clubs and don't want to play for these clubs, but there's a lot of politics that goes behind. And I think you look at it, a lot of things have happened recently with players and what goes on. And now with the Amazon documentaries, I think fans are getting a greater insight, you know, and it's not always the player's fault or the player's become greedy or the player doesn't want to be there. There's a lot, you know, there's managers who have egos and there's managers who also are very insecure. And there's a lot of insecure managers in football, and there's certain players and certain pedigree of players that might bring a bit of a fright to managers, you know, and it goes on and it's been going on a long time. For me, it was at the time where people in powers, be it that club, didn't want me there.
Right.
But because, again, of not having social media for me to get my say, it could be friends of friends who are working in newspapers and they can put whatever they want out. And then when you go out in the papers trying to defend yourself all the time, it gets a bit tiring. So, like I said, just to keep it short, it's the fact of the powers that be at the club didn't want me there and they wanted me to go. And I had no option. But again, in the papers, I was the villain or villainizers, the bad apple, the this, the that. And it's funny because I always still look back when people ask me about that. I said, damn, I must have been some real personality to be 21 years old and have such an influence against Teddy Sheringham and the likes of those guys who were in the dressing room when the guys won the treble. And he's listening to a 21-year-old, 22-year-old kid who's just started his career.
Yeah.
And I was the bad apple in the dressing room. So it's It's all things that doesn't surprise me now. So even if you look at the modern game now, again, with what players are talking about, with the likes of Sterling and Rashford and the heights that these guys have taken, all these conversations that are being had now are not new. These are things that have been going on in football from way, way back. But there was never a platform or no one was brave enough to talk about it because you knew the repercussions. And, you know, you look at what Sterling's done and the levels that he's taken it to and Marcus Rashford have taken it to. Amazing, you've got to applaud these kids. Yeah, because they've been finally brave enough to come and take it. You know, and there's other players who had a platform, other big names that we talk about now from our generation. There were times when they had a platform to say something, but they didn't. And, you know, it's this young generation who are, all they're fighting for is just equality.
Yes.
You know, don't tarnish everyone with the same brush, and that's it. And we've seen it, you know, with certain words that are used and everything like that. So that was kind of the best way to describe how I left West Ham, because that's a lot of stuff that went on there.
Okay.
And it's those types of scenario where I wasn't wanted, but they didn't want to come and say it out themselves. And it was just to vilify me as the bad guy, and I didn't want to be there, and X, Y, and Z, and promises weren't kept. And it is what it is. You just keep moving forward.
So, that was a move. I mean, that's the first time you're moving away from London since you're a young kid. Obviously, you know, you came back here at six, you played for Wimbledon, then you wouldn't have had to move playing for West Ham. Now, all of a sudden, you're moving to the Midlands and playing for Aston Villa. What was that like? You were 24, 25 at the time?
Yeah, I think it was 24. It was. I couldn't even tell you because I didn't have no expectations of what's what.
Okay.
You know, I know Aston Villa, again, were another big club, passionate club, and the second city in Birmingham. I knew there was great rivalry between themselves and Birmingham City. And it was only till I got into the club and got a bit more settled, you know, a couple of months in, that you realise, again, how big a club it is. And again, I was very fortunate because it was the same thing as West Ham. It literally was the second chapter of that family kind of club, the family atmosphere. And again, at the time, Martin O'Neill was signing players and he was big on personalities. And we had a dressing room full of amazing personalities again. And for me, it was like West Ham again, 2.1.
Cool.
Big personalities. Gabby Abonglo was a big personality there. But he grew more into a personality. Because at first he went there, he was shy. And the thing with me and Mike, the thing with my career is I've always been this way from young.
Right.
So I've always been this way from young. And again, you know, captaining Wimbledon, 19 years old or 18 years old, you know, I don't know a lot of captains who've captained championship clubs at 18, 19 and then gone on to captain Premier League clubs. So I've always had to be a stand-up guy and a lead. And I've always learned as my captain throughout my time, what can I do better to become a better leader? So you're always sitting there. You know, you're always trying to get the team together and good camaraderie. At Aston Villa, again, you know, you've got the likes of John Carew, Gabby, Ashley Young,
Leon
Petrov, Emil Heskey's a real nice guy with a big personality that a lot of people don't know that side of Emil Heskey. You know, and Zach Knight, we had James Collins come in, Richard Dunny, Stephen Warnock, Stephen Sidwell. Like, we had a dressing room that was massive in personality and character. And again, that is the reason why we did so well as a club, because it was the same thing, very competitive in training, but also in games, we were super competitive. And I think the one thing that was different from Aston Villa to West Ham was, let's just say the winning culture was built in a different mindset at Aston Villa, where you didn't want to lose. You did not want to come in on Monday and not at least have 1 point, because it was not a great atmosphere for the rest of the week until the next game.
Right.
Like, you did not want to lose. And that's how the winning culture, I felt, was established at Aston Villa. It was more about winning or getting a point, and that's the only two things that's acceptable.
Can I ask you about this, Nigel? Because obviously you're at Villa between sort of 2007 and 2011. So, you know, you left there. Well, that's 10 years ago that you left. How was it changing? You spoke earlier and you said, you know, this was when you were at Wimbledon. You didn't know how to prepare like we do now and stuff. So what I'm talking about is, what about diet? What about the nutrition? What about that kind of stuff? What was changing in the game when it came to things like that around that time?
That was, I think for me, the one of the most inspiring and influential guy that I met within that industry was when I first started, a guy called John Goodman, who worked at Wimbledon. He was fantastic. And the thing about with fitness and football is, the fitness coach has to have a relationship with players.
Yeah.
And I'm the type of guy from young, I've always said it from young, that there is an individual aspect to football. You know, you cannot look at other players and say, oh, just because they do it, that you have to do it. Everyone's unique in their gift physically of what they were. Like, whenever we did running, long distance running, people make fun of you about Nigel's back, because I was always at the back of the line struggling because I can't do long distance running.
Right, okay.
Like, I struggled with it. But when it came to a game, you get the Optimat stats of distance covered and stuff. I was always in the top three.
Okay.
Always in the top three of distance covered for games and stuff. So I can do it in a competitive level of that. But when it's just the long distance running and you get some coaches who'd like, oh, you got to do this, or you're not good enough, or the goalkeeper's beating you. No, because I'm not a long distance runner. I'm a footballer.
Yeah.
So you put me in a game, the competitive nature comes in me, and I'll always be one of the top three distance covered within the team every game. And that's just how competitive I was when it came to the game. And again, it's about being individual and not tarnishing everyone with the same brush. And I know in some other countries, you heard how training techniques were, how it was individual for certain people, like AC Milan, I believe, when is it client Zadoff was that? Was it Zadoff or was it AC Milan? Damn it. Is it Zadoff or? Oh, I think it's Zadoff.
Okay.
When he was at AC Milan, he used to train in a sandpit because of his thighs.
Wow.
You know, and there's not many teams in England who brought that kind of aspect over it. But you look at Barcelona as well, they've got a sandpit where they train certain players because it's a different kind of fitness and it's more individual based. But wow. John Goodman was good for me at a young age, but then that was still when it was the old school bleep test, this, that, and all that. But John Goodman, you can see when you had conversation with him, he was one of those fitness guys that was already ready to take it to the next level.
Sure.
About diet, sleep, hydration before games and all that. But I'll probably say one of the guys that I met that's probably the most influential for me fitness-wise is a guy called Tony Strudwick. Now, Tony Strudwick, I met at England Under-21s for one of my first call-ups at England Under-21s. And then from England Under-21s, thank God, he got a job at West Ham. So then he became the West Ham fitness coach, and he was really good. But Tony Strudwick was always forward-thinking. And there's no surprise that after he left West Ham, he went to, I think, Blackburn. And then from Blackburn, he ended up at Manchester United.
Okay,
you know, and he was there for some good years under Alex Ferguson. You know, they won a lot. And he's probably one of the most forward-thinking fitness guys I've ever met, where he talked about everything. You know, he talked about sleep before games and hydrating yourselves before games, hydrating yourselves after games, doing prehab, preventions for injury so you don't get injured. And these are things that we never used to do before. Because you used to get to training.
Yeah.
You go out half an hour before, they'll tell you just stretch and be careful. Don't ping balls all over the place and get injured. But there was nothing about prevention before, so you don't get injured. But Tony Strudwick was one of the guys who was thinking about all these things already beforehand. The importance of what you eat, how you sleep. He was the first one that told me about a power nap. I didn't even know what a power nap was.
I love a power nap, mate.
I did not believe it until I actually tried it. And he was like, yeah, put on an alarm on for 20 minutes. Wake up to no more than 20 minutes, because when you go beyond 20 minutes, you go into a deeper sleep, a deeper consciousness, and you don't do that. And I did it, and I'm like, oh my God, I actually feel energized. And I couldn't believe it. But these are things he was saying and implementing for so many years ago. And like I said, there's no surprise he ended up at Manchester United and being so successful in the industry and the career that he worked in.
How did you look after yourself sort of away from the club and away from the game in terms of like your nutrition? Because, you know, just talking to you, you're very articulate, very thorough. And I would love to know how you kind of approached it outside of what they did for you in the club.
Oh, yeah. Again, it's about evolution. You know, like I said, you started to see the change of Tony Strudwick. Then as players, we started to see the change on how football was as well. Because, you know, you'd be worried for pre-season. Because we'd have to go, you go to pre-season, some clubs would want to just start running you straight away.
Yeah, I've heard
for the first week, it's nothing but bleep tests and 800, 100 and stuff like that. But then even then, clubs started to evolve themselves where you'd come in and the first couple of days would be easing you back in and everything would be ball orientated. And for me, I was always a firm believer in that as well. I always used to believe from my younger days, I used to say, why are we not using the ball? Like, we are footballers. So, yes, we can work hard with the ball. But why is it that some clubs just want to run you, and say, okay, when you're at that level, then you can start using the ball. And then they get upset when certain players can't use the ball on the pitch because they're so tired. And I think that one of the guys that I heard who changed that approach in the game as well was Arsene Wenger at Arsenal. You know, when Arsenal would come back in, they'll just play very light, small-sided games and then gradually build it. And he believed in getting the fitness from games. And every player will tell you, there's no greater way to get match fit than playing games. But there's nothing you can do. No matter what kind of running they can invent, what kind of running technique, there's no way better to get fit than match fit. So we saw the difference anyway, as we were getting older, that pre-season now, they'll pay a lot more attention to your body fat and your weight when you come back in. So now that put the emphasis on us in the off-season to take more care of ourselves.
Yeah.
So even if pre-season starts in 2 weeks, players would start running a week before and doing their own kind of fitness before they even get back into pre-season. You know, and for me, it was getting the balance right of, yes, enjoying my time off because rest is just as important for your body.
Yeah.
But two, making sure that there's that maintenance level there, like slight level of maintenance where when you go back into pre-season, your body doesn't go into complete shock and shuts down and you get injured. So it's just getting that balance right of doing a little bit yourself, being professional, but also always, it's always been eating right as well.
Sure. You
know, eating right for me was never a problem.
Really?
You know, it was never a problem for me to eat right. And it's always having that balanced diet of sometimes you'd have like a steak and whatever it is. Sometimes you'd have a fish. But I was always a big fan of greens as well and salads and spinach and stuff like that. So I've always been a big fan of having a balanced diet.
I was going to say as well, I see a lot of the lads like on Instagram these days, you know, they go away for their holidays. Obviously, you know, you got your Mykonos, Ibiza and all that. And I would imagine you did all of that. But I suppose I've seen some of them. They're doing training out there. So they're kind of, they're on holiday, but they're, like you said, they're trying to keep that fitness so they don't get absolutely smashed when they come home. I mean, I take it you would go on and go do the lads' holidays and all that kind of thing. But would you have sort of one eye on, you know, getting back and being half decent?
Yeah, for sure. I think, like I said, the first couple of years, I can't say we did that.
The first
couple of years, we knew we were going to get battered anyway because it's pre-season. We were still in the dinosaur thinking age of run, bleep test, 800 metres, 600 metres, then 400, then 100 metres, like just run us ragged. So then the evolution started to change when obviously technical abilities of players got better and players on the ball improved. And, you know, a lot of people copy each other in football. You know, first it was 4-4-2 was a great formation. Then all of a sudden now people playing 3-5-1 and everyone now starts playing 3-5-1 because it's the better formation than 4-4-2. And that's what happened in football. You know, the evolution happened where clubs started to take more time in getting players fit for the season, but taking the pre-season time or what it's there for is pre-season. But it's not running them ragged at the first couple of days. It's more now getting more games in and more football work and football orientated stuff makes players fitter, and small-sided games makes players fitter. So you would then, as I saw that progression, it was like you said there, then you'd have a blast the first 2 weeks, then the second 2 weeks of the holiday, you slightly relax, you know, and you start running and getting a balance of running and fitness and simple gym work, simple strength exercises. So when you do go into pre-season, you're in a better condition and better state.
Yeah. Tell us, I want to sort of go through in the next sort of 10 minutes. I really appreciate your time, Nigel. I'm really enjoying this conversation. I hope you are too. I want you to tell me through the kind of like your rest of your career from obviously Villa, then Bolton, then Ipswich before it took you to the States and to where you are now. So I'll let you kind of just carry this on without me prompting you to talk about each club.
I mean, it's just very simple. I just think that for me, in my time then, you probably look at a lot of players in that time as well. We saw the change in football. You know, football really did become a capitalist thing, and it has become very capitalistic because it's all about mass production and numbers.
Yeah.
You know, you got for us in our generation, every one of us that made it to be a professional football player and to play at that level, for whether it's 3-4 years plus, there's probably, you look at maybe, roughly, let's just say, with all the teams you played with, Sunday League and all the teams, there's probably thousands of kids who didn't make it.
Sure.
So we're grateful. So now clubs play more of a numbers game where they're getting loads of kids in. And for them, it's, we want young players to come through so we could sell them on. So we saw that first big change in clubs changing their mentality, where it wasn't about who's available and how good they are. It's, we'd rather bring this young kid through and then maybe we could sell him. So clubs started to go down that young channel of we want young players, we want young players. So players at my age who are still very capable weren't being able to get clubs. And for me, I think that that's kind of what happened to me. I just came in that big period where loads of players were on free transfers and struggling to get clubs because certain clubs were just more focused on the academy system and bringing youngsters through and wanting to sell them. You know, so I had a great time with Owen Coyle at Bolton. I think he's a fantastic manager. You know, very underrated, very positive guy, super positive. And he was a pleasure to work with him and play for him. And I just felt for him because at the time at Bolton, it was very difficult for him because you can't make that club survive or stay up when you had 11 players coming out of contract and didn't have a contract.
Wow.
And, you know, it becomes a bit selfish. So how can a manager motivate 11 players who didn't have a contract, didn't know where they were going to be next year? And I think that's what kind of let that club down because of the fact of the players just didn't have contracts. You know, and it's hard for a manager to be in that position and motivate them. Then from then, obviously, we had a conversation and got relegated. But also that's the experience of the Fabrice Muamba situation.
Wow.
Which kind of brings it back about how important life is.
Wow.
And I think for me, I just wanted to be closer to my family. And then kind of ended up at Ipswich for a couple of months doing Paul Jewell a favour. And then after he got tired of this generation and what was going on in the change in football as well, he left, even though he asked me to come to Ipswich.
Wow.
And then ended up in Vancouver. You know, and it was a new chapter for me in the MLS. It was to try something different. And that league is completely different.
How did that come about?
It was just the fact of, I don't know, some conversations were being had again. And I was kind of open to trying and experiencing new things as well. You know, I just got married and my wife was American. And it was one of those leagues that potentially has potential to grow. But again, you see the difference in American MLS league compared to playing in Europe. And I think for me, it's just the cultural aspect of it. American sports is dedicated for the entertainment side of things.
Sure, sure.
Thanks. Yeah. Our sport is about a sense of community, a sense of belonging, a sense of pride in the city that you're from. And it belongs to us as our fans. While American sports, owners can move teams whenever they want because it's a franchise. They can do what they want. So really, there is no belonging to a community or anything like that over here. So experiencing the MLS was that kind of experience that I had for me, where you kind of learn that side of things and you see more the business dynamic that comes behind it. And again, to a certain degree, if you want to link anything to it, you look at the talk of what happened with this whole Super League thing and the men behind that who were trying to spare that Super League situation. And no surprise, it was going to be financially backed by an American bank, Chase, Goldman Sachs. And a lot of the guys who were spearlining it were American execs. You know, and they're trying to create basically another MLS, NBA, NFL, where owners of these clubs make money and get financially rich, and there is no threat of relegation and all that.
Yeah.
And I think credit to the fans for revolting, because, you know, these clubs belong to them, regardless of how wealthy these guys, the club is about them. And it was there before these wealthy guys ever became wealthy or came there. You know, these clubs were always there and it belonged to the people. So, I just basically went on that journey. You know, played in Montreal with Didier Drogba, played in the equivalent to the Champions League final over in CONCACAF. We played Club America, which is a Mexican team, and we played them at the Aztec Arena. So I got to play in the Aztec Arena.
Amazing.
We played about 110,000 people.
Wow.
And, also played in the second leg at 60,000 people at the Olympic Stadium in Montreal. So I had some good experiences there, but I always look at everything as a learning thing. You know, you learn to move forward, to get better. And I think that the experiences I had in England, my tough time at West Ham, my indifferent time at Aston Villa, both experiences carried me for the rest of my career in a long way. That everything else I experienced just didn't surprise me or didn't knock me off or, you know, had me shaking in any kind of way.
Can I ask before we come into the present day? It sounds obviously like you got very disillusioned with kind of like where the game was going in, especially in the Premier League. So it probably kind of almost compounded that, right, when you went to the MLS and seen how it was going there, or have I got that wrong?
No, it wasn't disillusion. It was just a surprise, and it's just basically change is going to come regardless. You know, like you said about how fitness changed in the game as we got older and how it is now to what we used to do back then, people wouldn't even believe you. So for us, it was just a fact of it's just becoming more of a capitalistic game.
Yeah.
It's all about money, you know, and I think fans can clearly see that now. It's all about money in shirt sales for most of these owners. You know, you got to remember the times when we were playing, football clubs were generally owned by local wealthy business guys who came from that city or grew up in that city. It was owned by people who have a deeper connection to the club, and it was about success and winning. Now a lot of these clubs are owned by people who never grew up in that city, never even supported that city. They're just business people and businessmen. And I think if you look at it now, the best way you can look at that and compare it is you look at Arsenal's current situation now. You can laugh at Arsenal, what the club was about to where they're at now. Mm. Their owner owns the LA Rams, you know, the Gronke family. And I'm sure he's a lot more invested in his Rams than he is in Arsenal Football Club.
Yeah.
And it's there for everyone to see. And it's all about money and business for them. They'll be thinking, okay, well, we're still financially viable around the world. We're still making shirt sales. We're still Arsenal. Everyone knows us. But to the fans who truly care about Arsenal, they want to be competing with Manchester City and Liverpool. They want to be up there like with Chelsea and competing for Premier League titles.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what people don't realise, that clubs used to be owned by local wealthy business people who grew up in that city, who have a connection to that club. And then now it's all corporate owned. So we saw that change coming. It is all about young players and selling players. And the perfect way to put it to people to see is look at Chelsea now. Look how many youngsters are coming through Chelsea and how many they're selling. But that's been happening from years back in the investment they did in the academy and how many kids they had there.
Well, look at Tammy Abraham, who's just got that big move to to Roma.
To Roma, exactly.
Amazing. Okay, so I'm very aware of the time, Nigel. I've absolutely loved this conversation. I want to sort of do about another 5-10 minutes if we can. I want to talk about the present day, because when I was telling some of the lads I was speaking to you today, they were like, oh, what's he up to these days? And I was like, well, from my research and looking at his Instagram, he's based in America, and he's got a cigar company and a young family. So do you want to just tell us a little bit about kind of the game when you retired? I've got here that it was kind of around about 2018, I believe, and what life looks like now and what it looks like for the future for you, bud.
Yeah, I mean, for me, like I said, it's the change that was coming, and I was chasing it to still wanting to play. I still had desire, but the opportunities weren't coming. And wherever you went around the world, like I said, the game's changed so much now where everything is young, and then you come across so many different people within football. The reality of it is there's a lot of people in football who have no clue. That's the reality of it.
Yeah.
But it's kind of getting that acceptancy thing. And, you know, I'm still very good friends with, like I said, Zach Knight, Emil Heskey, and, you know, talk to Steele and Petrov and a few others. So we've seen the change. And I think what some players find hard is adapting after they finish playing and getting back into regular society. But I think for me, one thing that was never a problem for me is I was always, like I said, very genuine to who I was. And I always looked at myself as a genuine person. So getting back to out of that cycle, out of that, how do I describe that bubble, the football bubble, wasn't really a problem for me, because I always had really other interests.
Yeah.
I had other interests other than football. You know, I would still love to be involved in football because I know I've got so much knowledge and so much experience that I could definitely pass down. But again, it's the problem of there's so many insecurities from managers and coaches within the game now, where I would be seen as someone that might be a threat, where they wouldn't want me to come in, even just to help and lend a helping hand. And then there isn't that many great opportunities, you know. And I think that's something that we find hard, you know. And I definitely would love to be involved in the game and pass my knowledge and wisdom down. But it's just getting the opportunities. And for me now, it's kind of like, I'm not going to fight or keep fighting a battle just to get an opportunity when I know what I can offer. I was supposed to do my badges a year or two ago, 2 years ago, but I lost my mum. So I haven't had the opportunity to do it. And then I could still do it now. But again, it's the fact of you looking at it and speaking to friends who've already got their badges and got all the top qualifications. Just getting an opportunity for them is one of the hardest things to do, where they're even thinking that they've got everything, but they're just going to head in a different direction. Because even with all the badges and all the qualifications, all the highest honours you can get as a coach, they still can't get jobs. So you kind of think about it. I mean, I keep speaking to people and they keep telling me to do it, and I'm probably going to do it within the next year to definitely get it anyway. But at the main time, I'm just doing some media work now, and I've been actually covering a different region. I've been covering the Latin American Copa Libertadores.
Wow.
So I've become a lot more knowledgeable on the likes of, obviously, the Bocas, the River Plates, the Palmeiras, the Atletico Mineiro. So now with all these teams, I know Williams just come to join Corinthians. And in 2 weeks, I should be doing the semi-finals game. And I believe they'll be showing it on the BBC iPlayer. for the semi-finals of the Copa Libertadores, and I'll be doing a co-commentary with a guy called Callum Williams, who's over here as well, a British guy. So we'll be doing the semi-finals games coming up and then the finals of the Copa Libertadores.
Do you think television is something you'd like to pursue as well with the commentary? And I mean, I spoke to Chris Iwelumo and he absolutely loves it. You know, he's here, there and everywhere on TalkSport.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely would love to pursue that as well. You know, and getting again, though, it's just getting that opportunity again, because the problem now is so many football players are coming out of retirement without having any other kind of passion. And they're all going in the same channel. And for me, the cigar situation is something I've always done from a while back anyway. I've always had a fascination with cigars and smoked cigars. And now with my business partner, you know, something, an opportunity presented itself where you just can't turn away from it. So it's another passion outside of football. And it's a new chapter and you're meeting different people from different backgrounds again.
Yeah.
Where it can open other avenues and stuff. But I definitely love the commentary side of the game, the analytics side of the game and everything. And, you know, football still will always be my first love. But to be able to do something else is a great blessing because, you know, you speak to so many players and different people who still struggle when they come out of that football bubble of knowing who they are and having something else to do, you know, because you've still got a long way to go in life.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I mean, we're still, still young, mate. At 37, you're a pup, mate. You're 5 years younger than me. What is the name of the cigar company?
Well, we called ourselves the Terrible Cigar Club.
Okay.
And the reason why we did that is because myself and my business partner spoke to some people close to us of why we thought, what we thought about doing. And they said, no, that's a terrible idea. You're never going to make it because obviously she's a Cuban female and I'm a black guy from London and it's going to be a difficult industry to break into again. And they said it's a terrible idea. So we said, okay, cool. So we're going to call ourselves the Terrible Cigar Club. You know, we've got online subscription and we've also got a physical location in Sunset Drive in Miami.
Amazing.
Which is great. And everything's going well so far. And again, it's something that I like doing.
Go on, and that's where you are now. You're in Miami.
Just north of Miami. Just outside of Miami. So I know Kieran Gibbs has just joined into Miami. And
yes.
I'm going to meet him soon. Jason Roberts is up here. Mr. CONCACAF, I call him Jason Roberts. So he's in the paper pushing side of football now and he's enjoying it. And there's a few people that are out here, a few ex-players. Lloyd Sam's here now, and he's just started to get into commentary side of things now,
brilliant,
football-wise. So you do see some players and you do speak to people.
So family-wise, I saw you holding a young one on your Instagram. Is that your offspring?
Yeah, finally got the boy. Got two beautiful girls and now finally got the boy.
So, you've got three kids. Wow, amazing.
Three kids. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what direction he takes now. But he's going to be a bit of a sport brat living in America. So he might want to play baseball.
Yeah.
He's got some thick thighs. So I think he's going to be probably a running back in the NFL.
How old are you doing?
But we'll see. 5 and 7.
Amazing.
5 and 7.
You've got your hands full.
4-month-old. Yeah, I know. I definitely know.
Excellent. So just before we sign off, bud, how do you look after yourself, like post career? Because you're not going into training every day. You've got that need to get up because you're not earning money from the game anymore and train. But you look very fit and healthy, bud. Tell me a little bit more about what your day to day training looks like.
Well, I think for me, it's just low maintenance. You know, I mean, I'm still in a WhatsApp group with some of the Villa guys, so they keep it competitive. And at one point, I was being very competitive. And I'm like, what am I doing? I'm no longer playing anymore anyway. So for me, I'm just going to go back to the maintenance kind of level. So what I generally do is I try and run at least 15 miles a week. And then I like using my own body weight because if I go to the gym and start pushing weights, I bulk up really quickly and really easily. It's just my physical capabilities.
Yeah.
So what I like to do is just simple push-ups, core work and ab work, like sit-ups and stuff like that, and then I'll do like a 5 mile run. I mix it up sometimes and I'll just do 5 miles straight. So 1 week I'll go on Monday, I'll go for a run, then I'll run on Wednesday and then run on Friday and then enjoy the weekend off. And then the next week I might do interval running. I might just do 4 fours, so 4 minute on, 4 minute off, and then that's a different type of cardio. And just keeping myself, just maintaining that kind of level of fitness, just simple like that. And then obviously also then, it's also about the lifestyle outside of that. Again, eating well, balanced eating diet.
Yeah.
A couple of glasses of red wine a night now with the meal. And then tequila is my new best friend now. So wine, tequila is my new best friend and a bit of scotch.
I was going to say, but if you're in the cigar trade, I expect that comes with a few expensive whiskies and things like that, yeah. Right?
Yeah, so it's the Scotch tequila. I'm not really a beer drinker. No. You know, I don't do the beer thing. But like I said, it's kind of getting everything right. So you take care of yourself, you get the balance right of your diet, of eating well. And obviously, you've been to America before, I assume.
Yeah.
Big portion. So you've seen the portions out there and how they are. So, yeah. So the, yeah. And I'm someone that actually likes to cook a lot as well. So I cook a lot of home meals. So I'm not someone that likes to go out a lot and eat out and do all that fast food stuff. I'd rather cook, you know, and cook for my kids and see them cooking.
Amazing.
So they can see me cooking, that they'll be more accustomed to cooking at home themselves when they get older.
Nigel, it's been over an hour, mate. I've really, really enjoyed it. I hope you have too. I could see you getting excited.
Yeah, likewise.
Cup final and stuff like that. I really think all my followers are going to get some great value from this. So what I'm going to do, buddy, is in a second, I'm going to end the recording here. I want to say thank you once again. I'm very, very grateful for you. You didn't have to do this today. You didn't know who I was or anything like that, but it really means a lot, mate. And, you know, listening to you and you just seem like just very content and very happy. And it's really refreshing, because like you say, there's so many guys now that are coming out of the game and struggling with mental health. So it's just been really nice hearing your story, mate, and seeing how well you've adapted, like, kind of post career. So
honestly, I appreciate that.
I'll stay in touch, because I'm gonna tap you up to maybe pass me on to someone who I can interview next. But guys, thanks for tuning in. If you're watching this on YouTube, please subscribe, leave us a comment. And obviously, if you find us on iTunes or Podomatic, don't forget to leave a comment and a review and a like and a share. We really appreciate this. I've been Coach Treggs. This has been Nigel Riococca. Thank you so much for your time, Nigel. I'm going to end recording.
No problem.
I'll talk to you guys soon.